From Pacifica Radio, KPFT 90.1 Houston, this is Open Journal in Exile. Open Journal is the Houston community magazine of the airwaves. Join us as Duane Bradley and Stephanie Coleman explore the wonder that is the Petro Metro and the people who make it happen. And now from our temporary, socially distanced, alternative studios in exile, somewhere in the greater Houston area, this is Open Journal in Exile. Let the conversation begin.
Yes, yes, yes. Welcome aboard. You are tuned in to Open Journal on Pacifica Radio, KPFT Houston. I'm Duane Bradley.
And I'm Stephanie Coleman. Among the methods used to help slow the spread of the COVID-19 virus, beyond hand washing, social distancing, masking up, and getting tested, is the process known as contact tracing. If someone tests positive for COVID-19, a contact tracer from the Houston Health Department will contact you by phone, email, or even text message. Making a choice to work with contact tracers helps protect your family and your community by slowing the spread. It involves tracking down persons who may interact with someone who's contacted the virus and helping them self-quarantine, as well as finding other resources. The City of Houston has hired hundreds of contact tracers to assist in getting a handle on this deadly pandemic. Many of us have only heard information about this process, some of it perhaps not fully accurate, some even incorrect or even misleading. Join us as we discuss the job as contact tracers with Basil Simon, a graduate of Michael E. DeBakey High School and a junior at Vaughn College in New York City, as well as global traveler Jackson Cloyd, who is a former student at the Houston Academy of International Studies and is enrolled at the University of Houston. They are both Eagle Scouts that have served as friends and volunteers to KPFT. Basil Simon and Jackson, welcome back, and thank you for joining us today on Open Journal.
Glad to be here. Glad to be back.
It's great to see you. Even though we're not all in the same studio we've shared in past years, we thank you for joining us on Open Journal, because in addition to the being Eagle Scouts and upstanding young men in the community and juniors in college here and in New York City, you both have worked summer jobs here for the City of Houston Health Department as those contact tracer folks. I've only seen like some stories in the Houston Chronicle, and I saw like some drone footage in the George Brown of like all these people spread out in this vast space in these cubes that were apparently sitting in front of telephones and computers and going through this process that a lot of people have heard about, but maybe are not familiar enough with it to feel comfortable should the occasion arise that they're being contacted by someone, either because they have tested positive or they've come in contact with someone who has. So we've heard a lot about contact tracing anecdotally, but y'all have been working down in the trenches over the summer. How is it, you know, how has it been now that you're heading back to college? How is it each day as a contact tracer? You know, what is it that you do, and why is it important for our listeners to not just hang up or ignore that outreach from someone who says, "Hi, I'm calling from the Houston Health Department. I'm a contact tracer." Click. What? Why should we not click and just ignore that call if and when it comes? Because eventually, won't it come to most of us?
Yes. So I would say that being the contact tracer, we get those a lot about people hanging up, or they might ask a few questions and then they say, "Oh, never mind," and then they hang up. But it is an important task, because the information that we ask is more in relation to statistics and sort of having an understanding of what each person's going through and how they might affect other people. Because sometimes you call somebody, they tested positive a month ago, and they still have the disease, but they never experienced symptoms the whole time. So for us, that's an interesting case to review with the health department, because it shows that not everybody gets it, let alone not everybody recovers within 2 weeks. Or some people, they might have these horrible symptoms. Like they go through it, they're coughing, they're vomiting, and they're doing all these other things. But then 3 days later, they're fine. And another 2 weeks after that, they're healthy as a horse. So it's like knowing those type of differences is important for us, and being able to document it so that people know on the higher up where to do and where the resources need to go.
Jackson?
Basil pretty much said what I was going to say, actually. Being that it's all relatively new, like the virus is relatively new, and we're all trying to gather as much data as possible, answering the question that we ask just allows us to get more data so that we can have the statistics and everything that we need in order to like progress and move forward with this pandemic, and like so that we can get out of the pandemic state that we're in right now. And I think that's what the biggest part is.
So, you know, it's interesting, you know, a few months ago, the world was, you know, in perfect order. No one ever thought that this would be our reality. What was it like being in the GRB? And it's really quite a historic experience to be in the fourth largest city in the nation as a part of its pandemic response. That's really leading the nation in change. What was it like walking into the GRB every day that most people go to for conventions and conferences, and you're, you know, calling to change lives and save lives?
Jackson, you can speak on this.
At first, it felt kind of cool because, like, I had been to the Georgia Brown for conventions and stuff like that. And so when we did the initial tour, I was like, wait a minute, I've seen, like, booths set up and, like, little, like, vendor stalls and stuff, and it was weird. But it was really cool. It made me feel like I was like doing some like really, really official. And technically, it was very official stuff. But it was kind of like a movie. It didn't feel like exactly real at first. Mm-hmm. But like once I was in there, I was like, okay, I got to do the work. But
there was the other side of that coin.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, it was a unique experience because I remember when I was first going in, it was like the first wave of contact tracers that they had hired. So most of the setup for the Georgia Brown right now wasn't officially set up yet. They were still getting the spots that they needed to actually divide the sections and how they were dividing up the teams. So for us, it was like, it almost looked like a ghost town because it was our little area and then the rest of it was still empty because there was nobody else there except for the people that were there like a couple weeks prior. So for me, it was like, oh, this is like a huge space for only like 60 people, because that's what the first wave was. But then as the weeks go on, it's like more and more building, like placements and more like office spaces. And you realize, wow, this is a lot bigger than anybody could imagine. Just seeing that was very unique and very interesting.
Mm-hmm. It is, you know, as both of you have traveled and really exploring, as you say, how unique it was to be a part of watching it grow to really serve such a huge city. You have a unique perspective on the pandemic. You're sort of on the outside of it as a Houstonian. You're on the inside of it as a contact tracer. When you speak to your other classmates in other cities and countries and keep connected, how do you feel Houston is doing by comparison? Do you see that people really need this service? Do you see the value in it compared to maybe other countries or cities?
I mean, I think at least relative to other cities, especially like internationally speaking, we should have done this earlier. But yeah, I mean, it's a very necessary service, but we should have started doing this earlier because if you look at, and when I've talked to other people from other cities, they're just like, what are you guys doing? They're like, how are you guys just started wearing masks? And they're like, you reopened up stuff. And it's like, I know the places that they've been on lockdown since March and now they're just starting to reopen. Now they only have like a couple of cases. Like in New Zealand, for example, I think they've had their first four cases within the past, like their initial first four cases, they got them within the first, I mean, a couple of weeks ago. Like I think it was like a week or two ago. And so it's just like those kind of things. I think that's like my biggest, that's what has been brought to my attention by other people from other communities. But it's a very important service because otherwise you're not going to know if you've been in contact with somebody who has had it unless they tell you. And a lot of times people, they'll like feel embarrassed, so they won't say anything about it. And that leads to the exponential rate that we see right now, or have been seeing in the past too.
I would have to say the exact same thing, because I was in New York when it happened at first, and them being on quarantine was like super realistic, and they were like, they did it immediately. So like I didn't know anybody that got into contact, but I also knew a lot of people that like stopped doing everything just to stay like locked down. Mm-hmm. And the people that like, when I came down here and I would see it, it's like, well, I can see us needing to be in contact because it seems like a lot of people are still out and about and still not having as a serious issue on it. Or some people I've talked to, they just aren't as informed on it. So they're like, I don't know it enough. So I'm just going to keep on doing what I'm doing, because I know you can get it, but that's not going to happen to me. And then even when people I've called, they say like, oh yeah, I didn't think it was going to happen to me, because it was just like a small get together with like 10 people. It's like, okay, yeah. So 10 people is a lot. And contact tracing helped, because they were like, oh, I didn't realize I was in contact with somebody that might have had it. Because some people, they get in contact, they don't develop any symptoms, but some people do. So you just have to let people know that like you have been in contact, or letting people know the exact stakes that are on the line of being a contact tracer sort of helps with that.
Mm-hmm. You're tuned to the Open Journal on KPFT Pacifica Radio in Houston. We are visiting with Basil Simon and Jackson Cloyd, who have been serving the city of Houston this summer, working as contact tracers. We're exploring that with them. And we thank you for joining us and supporting this independent radio voice. Thanks. I'm Dwayne Bradley.
And I'm Stephanie Coleman. You know, Basil, you mentioned that there's a lot of misinformation that, you know, people are afraid. And Jackson, you said that, you know, people might be embarrassed. We also have noticed that there's myths out there that your telephone number and that your social security and banking information are required. But that is false information. Is that correct?
Definitely false.
Yeah, that's we don't
ask for any of that.
We're not supposed to ask for any of that.
Yeah.
So it's really about public health and sort of getting the information to people so that they can behave better.
Yes. So the only thing we actually ask people that might be personal, that's like, that could be used for anything, is a birth date for somebody, as well as their address. And we use those as identifying pieces of information. Because if you really think about it, how many people do you know have the same birthday as you, let alone the same name and the same birthday? So that really reduces the amount of people that we know that we're contacting, that we know it's them. And the address is just to know if they're in Houston, because if they're not in Houston, if their address is, as an extreme example, in Iowa, well, Houston services can provide for somebody in the state of Iowa. So we just have to know the address in order to say, hey, you either have it or you've been in contact with somebody, and we can transfer you to the correct department in order for them to get the resources they need. Because some people, they might need some basic housing needs, or they might need some like food needs. And as Houston, we can't provide that. But if you live in our Houston area, then we can. So it's just, that's the only identifying information we ever ask. Mm.
So Jackson, walk me through with you, if you could briefly, an average day as a contact tracer down at the GRB. You walk in, of course, you're probably being scanned to make sure that you're cool to be there. You probably have to have a wristband on so that they know that you've been scanned and that you're cool to be there. You make your way to your workstation. So from there, what is it that you're given, and what is it you're asked to do? And walk us through that process a little bit, would you please?
So usually once I come in, they'll assign us. We have a system where they assign us cases, which are the people who we have to get into contact with. And so I'll like set up my agenda, and I'll like plan out, boom, I'm going to call this person at X time, the next person at another time, boom, boom, lay it all out. And then I just go down the list, make the call, contact the person, hopefully, if they pick up the phone and don't hang it up. Then I get all the information that I can from them. And then depending on if they have contact, or if the case has contact, the case is the person who's confirmed to be positive for COVID-19, and then the contacts are the people who they've come into contact with. And so I'll call the contacts, get information from them, and then from there I forward that to my, we have like the quality assurance. And so they'll make sure that I have all the information correct and in the system. And then from there, they send it to, the Center for Disease Control. Boom. And so that's essentially, I just do that several times throughout the day. And that's, outside of going to lunch and like leaving, that's my day.
So you call me up. Mm-hmm. You're like, hey, Dwayne, I'm Jackson Cloyd. I'm contact tracer working for the city of Houston Health Department. Looks like you have been.
So like if you were the contact, I'd say, could we, you have come into contact with somebody who has been confirmed positive for COVID-19. Because it's, we have the HIPAA requirements, we can't give out the information of the person because it's confidential. We can't tell you who you come into contact with that exposed you to COVID-19, but we do have to inform you that you've been exposed to COVID-19.
Okay. Then, so you're breaking some bad news to me. It's like, yeah. Hey, Dwayne, you went somewhere and somebody, you were near somebody that you shouldn't have been around.
Yes.
Okay. Then what are you going to ask me or what are you going to tell me?
So usually I'll ask you the same question, like how many people have you been in contact with? Who have you been in contact with? Have you been isolating? And then just a couple of medical questions. And then after that, usually we'll continue to monitor you for the next 10 to 14 days. And then just to see if you have any symptoms or you start exhibiting symptoms or if you're recovering or anything of that nature. And then I'll encourage you to get tested just to make sure and see what you can see.
Yeah, so really, I guess if knowledge is power, if you at least know that you should be more thoughtful because you have been in contact, it prevents, I would say, almost like accidental spreading by not knowing that you might have it. Is that a part of the goal? I'm sure people are quite shocked to realize that they have been that close in contact with someone.
Yeah, for sure.
There are times where you contact somebody and then they get like pretty angry at themselves for it. So it only because when they meet somebody, they always think, oh, this is just like another friend. Cause it's usually close friends that are in contact with each other. And that's usually how it spreads. So you pass by, you say hello, you do like a little greeting or whatever. And then they might be with like eight other people. So it's like a small group of like eight people or so. And then somebody in the group had it, didn't say anything or didn't know it. And then they give it to them or they've been in contact with, and people get angry because like, oh, I should have known, or like he shouldn't have come through, or he or she shouldn't have come through. And then you realize for them that they probably feel all these emotions. Like I might catch it at some point in the next 2 weeks. I'll be off my job for 2 weeks. And then they get all this confusing feelings and emotions. But it's more about that, because some people, they come into contact with somebody and they don't catch symptoms and they never catch it themselves. But some people do, and the 2 weeks is to say, hey, you might develop these symptoms in these 2 weeks. So in order for you to not do that and not spread it to other people unknowingly, then 2 weeks is what is the recommendation in order to make sure either the actual disease is in you and like you stay isolated from somebody, or you don't develop the disease and the symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
So how, if you're making phone calls to people, how do I, as the recipient of a phone call, because I see a number, it's not anybody in my phone book, it's not matching up to anybody I've ever talked to before. I'm prone to probably not trust that number or engage with it unless I had some sense of security that it actually was a real call, not some kind of a scam. How do you prevent that kind of suspicion? Because we're being inundated by robocalls and scam calls and phishing calls and things like that all the time. Federal Trade Commission is on the warpath against that and not been able to ever really stop it from happening. So what does someone see if they have caller ID, what shows up? Is there like a thing that says, this is Houston Health Department calling? Is there some number that everybody will see? Is it like your name? It's like, hey, this is Basil. I just wanted to check in with you. You know, what's the identification that will allow people to not be so wary that maybe this is just another one of these, you know, scam deals going around?
Honestly, there is no guarantee, because some people, as like a scam, they got like the first few words. So then they might catch you on the first few words. For us, I believe it should come through as like a Houston Health Department number for a caller ID.
Uh-huh.
And okay. If I remember correctly, I think it's like 713-583.
853-8700.
Yes. Yeah. So that should be, if they keep it out on the look for that number, then they should know that mm-hmm. is one of us.
Mm-hmm.
But honestly, it's only if they ask information that seems out of the normal, like if they ask for banking accounts or they ask for social security, those type of things.
Those would be most likely scams, because that is not in line with the health department.
Yeah, that's not in line with what the health department asked, because those are information that could lead to people giving information that could affect them financially or personally. Mm-hmm. But the only thing we do ask people to confirm is a date of birth and an address, just so we know we're talking to the right person. We're not talking to like the sister or something, because even though they might be in the same, people might live in the same household and they might use the same number. So I can't rattle off to John Smith like about something when I'm actually trying to talk to like his brother, Henry Smith or something. Mm-hmm. So we ask those things just to make sure we're talking to the right person.
Very interesting. Well, you guys have had quite an interesting summer. But I think both of you have sort of shown us, and your generation has shown us, that life continues in spite of this pandemic. You're going back to school, you're continuing your journey. How would you recommend that people stay safe and have mental health days and relax in spite of all of this, for your age group and for everyone in general?
I personally, I'd take days where I'm just like, all right, I'm not going to do anything else. I mean, at first, I'm like, because I'm in school right now, so I make sure I get my work done and stuff like that. It's very important. Don't forget your work, kids. But I make sure that I take a day where I'm just going to chill and do whatever I want to do and just like relax and stuff. Because that way, I really don't like the online classes and stuff. And it's like frustrating for me. So in the midst of being frustrated all the time, I had to take time where I can be not frustrated. And that way I can like just like let everything flow and just hang out. And have it's like a reset kind of day. So that way when I go back, I'm refreshed and like I can go back to doing whatever I need to do. Because it's important. It's very important. Take time for yourself.
And I would also think that finding something online to do for like a hobby or something, this would probably be a good time to learn a hobby. Because I mean, I personally haven't done anything like skillful in a while. I've just mainly been doing school and that's it, working on what I need to work on. But now with this pandemic, there's really nothing else to do. So I recently got like a skateboard that I ordered, and now I'm by myself. So nobody's in contact with me. I'm usually in an area where not many people pass through. So even though I'm like outside, I still stay masked up, and those things allow me to develop a skill that I've always wanted to learn, and I can still do in a spot where I'm not coming into contact with people. So you don't always have to be inside to do something, but if anything, you can use inside as a time to reflect, maybe find something to do. And if you go, I wouldn't recommend going outside with groups of people, but if you go outside in a secluded area, hopefully close to home or something, you can find a spot and be able to do it and practice it.
Good advice. Hey, you know, there's one question that I didn't ask earlier, and I hate to close out without getting this one out of my head. It's like one of these brain worms. We noticed how well things went in South Korea in particular was really great, an example to the world of being able to, you know, deal with this quickly, effectively, efficiently. And one of the things that they seemed to do, and I didn't do a lot of research on this, and maybe y'all can enlighten me, but they would ask people to, like, give them their cell phone and then go back through it and, like, get data out of their phones of, like, who you were around and use that sort of, like, find my friends feature inside of the phones to track where they'd been and then use graphic overlays to see what kind of interactivity they had to do contact tracing that way. That's pretty high tech. I can't imagine a lot of Houstonians would say, oh yeah, here, take my phone, download whatever you want out of it. Is that science fiction for Americans, or is that real?
I mean, I would say, I mean, it's a pretty cool idea. It sounds kind of like science fiction, but I mean, they did it, so it's really not fiction anymore.
Right.
I would say that most Americans would not let that happen. Like, it'd be very hard for us to give up their cell phone data. Like, I would say so. I understand, like, why it makes sense to do it. And I mean, it does make a fair amount of sense to do it, but I could see very many people in general just be like, yeah, I'm not letting you have my phone.
Yeah. I think now it's a lot of people are worried about, like, their own security. So they, like, the fact that they have data on a certain location, especially on their phone, the fact that they would just willingly give it up for, like, the benefit of, like, no immediate benefit to themselves. It's just like, you take the data and you do whatever you want with it. It's not the same level of, like, if I give you the data, then I get something out of it. It's more of like just giving it to give it, and hopefully there's a benefit to it. So there's no, like, immediate benefit to it. So I wouldn't see it realistically being on a majority level of Americans doing it, let alone, like, people in Texas.
Yeah, that confirms exactly what I was thinking about in terms of Houstonians and Texans. So, really do appreciate some of your insights. I wish you well as you head back into a new school year. So stay safe and keep in touch with us, y'all. Basil Simon, Jackson Cloyd, want to thank you for joining us on our special Open Journal in Exile edition.
Well, thank you. It's all quarantine and fun.
All right. I'm Dwayne Bradley.
And I'm Stephanie Coleman. Remember, programs are available at archive.kpft.org. And please subscribe to our podcast, KPFT OJ. As always, we are a dedicated all-volunteer production staff, including Rambling Rick Campbell, Susan Phillips, and Maverick. Open Journal theme music provided by Kevin McLeod. And join us on Open Journal next time for more great conversations. We thank you for your pledges, and as always, we thank you for your support.
And as always, we like to leave you with a thought to carry you through the week. This comes to us from Mahatma Gandhi, who said, "It is health that is real wealth and not pieces of gold and silver." Take care of each other.